And the effect of spirulina on iron deficiency anemia treatment is even better than the positive control, the ferrous sulfate. Of course, we don't know specific reasons yet. That's actually what I'm working at ETH to answer. Why? Because the bioaccessibility, maybe because the structure of the iron is different, or maybe because spirulina also has a lot of phycocyanin, a blue pigment, a natural pigment. Maybe there are some combined structures. So quite interesting. So, and protein as for future food, 70%, also good, very good number. And actually spirulina is a major commercial microalgae biomass in the world, with a total production amount around, I think, more than 12,000 tons of the dry weight. And most of the spirulina produced in China, 70%.
I am today accompanied by Gao Fersang. He has been doing a lot of research in the application of microalgae to the acquisition of micronutrients in order to treat deficiencies. Hello, Gao. How are you?
Hello, Alex. Very good. You are good?
It's a pleasure to be able to talk with such a distinguished researcher as you are. I've seen in your CV that you have 23 publications, on which most of them have been featured by you as a prominent, as the principal contributor. And given that most of the PhDs can be acquired through the doing of three publications, which are connected in some way, the fact that you are so young and have been able to do 23 publications in your back is something I would consider to be remarkable.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Alex. First of all, thanks a lot for this invitation. I really like to have such a conversation to introduce my research, especially about microalgae. Yeah, actually, I worked on microalgae for more than 10 years. And I did actually two PhDs, one in China, one in the Netherlands, about different topics, but all about microalgae. From microalgae production, to single cell selection, to functionality assessment of microalgae valuable compounds. So different fields. I do like a lot about microalgae, and I believe a lot of microalgae. That's why I work a lot and for more than 10 years to generate some output. And so currently now I'm working at ETH as an established researcher to investigate the potential of using microalgae for iron deficiency anemia treatment and micronutrient deficiency treatment.
It is very surprising to me that the microalgae that we talked about in the first instance when we met can be used in so many ways to further the flourishing of humanity. I would like to give a short explanation of how my view of microalgae and more in general human flourishing is, so that people can understand why I was so surprised by your research and how in the moment we met in that conference, that is why my immediate reaction was that this was very promising and this is why I wanted to have a conversation with you. I think that creating a way of giving access to everyone in the world to cheap, reliable, abundant food, especially healthy food, would completely revolutionize everything. Because we are machines, we are built of certain components, and we need repairment and changing of these things. We need proteins and many things on which you could most probably explain in a much more eloquent way than I can. So we need a lot of things, and these things can be produced in certain ways, but the magnitude of the efficiency increase that can be achieved through microalgae is so massive that I think we are still not being able to realize the potential of it. Because right now, what we do as a society is have plants absorb energy from the sun, then take the carbon dioxide, photosynthesis, they absorb the carbon. And instead of eating those plants, most of the people, what they do is feed that plant into an animal. The animal eats it, wastes like 99% of the energy, and then that plant, that animal, we eat it. And then we transport it, and we assume all the inefficiencies in the process. And the microalgae would be not only the first step in the nutrient chain in our environment, but they are also very efficient at absorbing nutrients and producing the micronutrients in which you have been delving into. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, exactly. This is exactly what microalgae can do. For instance, I can introduce a little bit about just example like iron. For instance, beef is considered one of the best animal-based food for iron deficiency anemia treatment because animal-based food contains a large amount of heme iron. But those foods are expensive and not consumed by vegetarians or vegans and with quite limited consumption. For plant, normal for the normal plant-based food, and overall the iron concentration is very low. And in addition, they have a lot of inhibitors. For microalgae could produce like more than 100 times more iron than beef. So think about this number. That's why we are so interested in microalgae to produce some valuable compounds. Of course, also for protein and pigments, lipids, for the large amount of the compounds, this is also very interesting topics for many years in the whole world. For instance, microalgae can produce 70% of the protein of the dry weight, and sometimes more than 50% of the lipids, functional lipids. So we could expect a lot from microalgae, and they can use CO2, they can use light to produce this biomass from single cells. And of course, some microalgae species can also use organic compound to combine the heterotrophic and the mixtrophic an autotrophic to a mixtrophic way. So there are a lot of potential to produce high value compounds and future food from microalgae.
When you mentioned that microalgae has a potential 100 times higher than beef of production of iron, what yes. input were you making reference to? Energy, water?
This is just, to be honest, this is a concentration. So for instance, overall, if we take average of the iron from beef, it is around, let's say, 10 to 30 ppm, is milligram per kilo. But for microalgae, for instance, spirulina could contain iron rich to like more than 2,000 ppm. So think about 2,000 compared to 20 ppm. So this concentration could be more than 100 times higher compared to beef. But of course, we are going to test the absorption of the iron in human cells, because even the concentration is much higher. We don't know if the absorption is the same or not, because from beef, from salmon, from fish, those iron are heme iron. So the absorption pathways are different. So at ETH, what we are doing, we are comparing the absorption from microalgae and to compare to beef, to fish, to understand what is the form of iron from microalgae and what is the bioaccessibility, bioavailability, and bioactivity. So to have a clear picture what we can do with this iron from microalgae.
So it's not the same having the raw factors, in this case, the element of iron put into your bloodstream and have your body absorb it. Those two things are separate. In one case, we're just talking about how much of that thing you have, and in the other case, how much of that you can absorb and use for your vital objectives.
Exactly. This is a very important thing to think about it. And actually, to be honest, there are many algae experts working on algae production, but there are not so many food scientists and the nutritionists working on the absorption of the compounds from microalgae. So at ETH, we are filling this gap, and we are collaborating with I'm working is a joint project between Sustainable Food Processing Group, So, and the nutrition and the metabolic epigenetics. So these two groups with different expertise. So we can answer how to produce biomass with highly bioavailable iron. Then we can also answer the questions, how much percent of the nutrients from microalgae could be absorbed and what is the activity after absorption. So sometimes we tell people, for instance, one food, for instance, microalgae contains more than 70% of protein, but we don't know how much percent of the protein are accessible to your absorption. And even we know how much accessible, you don't know how much could be absorbed by your duodenum. And even you observe them, you don't know what is the functionality, what is the activity. So it's the same to other food or different. So this is what we are going to answer. And we do have an expectation, microalgae could have a better performance than traditional iron supplements because they are photosensitive microorganisms. They have chlorophyll, and chlorophyll structure is very close to heme. So we expect some innovative findings to understand the absorption of the microalgae, the iron from microalgae compared to the conventional food.
I am currently trying to put on some muscle and talking with a friend who is much better educated than I am in terms of chemistry and in general food sciences. He laughed at me when I mentioned that I was trying to maximize the number of the, in every packet of food, it says how many proteins per 100 grams. And I was trying to maximize that and get to, let's say, 200 grams per day of consumption. And he was laughing at me because he said that that number is such a rude measure of what I need that it doesn't say almost anything. And me trying to maximize this single measure only evidenced how ignorant I am of how many different aspects of every micronutrient there are. And in this case, a macronutrient of protein is segregated in so many fields, which one type of proteins could be less or more bioavailable for my purposes. And yeah, I think he made a good remark mentioning that I cannot focus in a single measure and try to maximize it to be happy with it. There's so much nuance.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So for instance, the iron from a plant-based food, even you know the concentration, there are some guidelines from WHO, FAO. For instance, the bioavailability of the iron from plant-based food in general will around 5 to 15%. So you can imagine that only 5% of the iron from plant-based food could be absorbed by your body. So when you check some products, and even though they have the same amount of the protein, same amount of the minerals, but the bioavailabilities could be quite big different.
I had an idea a few years ago, which I would like to share with you. I think I already did when we met, but it's very interesting to me, and I would like to have to put on the table some facts by you, which I'm completely oblivious to. I had an idea of making a luminous cube of water with bubbles of air being pumped beneath so that we could build a colony, I don't think the colony is the right word, of algae that would be incredibly efficient at absorbing that air due to the immense surface area in contact with the air. And we could introduce some LEDs emitting the right frequencies for the maximization of the photosynthesis, and that air would maybe profitably be injected with some extra carbon dioxide so that we can maximize the amount of chemical reactions that would further our objectives. And this idea that I had has to be backed by evidence of how efficient the microalgae are. For example, how do you have any idea of the conversion rate of energy from the sun or from these LEDs to the carbon absorbed in the algae?
To be honest, I'm not an expert for this field. I only know like general number. For instance, to produce 1 kilograms of the biomass, you need 2 kilos, around 2 kilos of CO2. So this is what I know for the number. But there are many fundamental publications about the photosynthesis deficiency, gas exchange, and different light spectrums, and also depends on the species. So different microalgae species have different photosensitive efficiency and also depend on the parameters. What I did a small experiment before in the Netherlands, for instance, to use different light spectrum, like blue light, red light, blue-red light, white light, to use different light. For specific microalgae, you could produce some specific compounds because and a certain wavelength, you could increase the photosensitivity, you could increase the energy transfer to the target products. So actually, this is a very interesting topic, but unfortunately, I don't have too much data in details.
What I find the most fascinating about this topic is that natural selection allows us to have different branches of microalgae and then see which ones maximize the feature that we are looking for and then use that as a much more efficient way to further our objectives than the raw version that we found in nature. Which are the different areas in which we have been able to do this artificial selection to further our objectives?
That's a very important topic, actually, because for microalgae industry, the strains are very important. If you have a robust strain, you could have a production with a much higher productivity, much stable production. For company, it is very important to have a stable production, to have a cost-effective production. So actually for selection, natural selection, it is very important method also in the labs because people can simulate some environment situations from the nature. Then you can select the strains after let's say many generations, you could find one mutant and the natural selection pressure. And this method is important. Why? Because this is very important for food and feed, because we all know that genetic engineering, UV and mutagenesis. So these are also very efficient ways to have some GMOs, but those microorganisms are bitten from genetic engineering is not allowed for food or feed. But for natural selection with some natural environment, the species you get are considered as wild type. So we could use those strains for food, for feed. So I can give one example. For instance, I selected some microalgae before, also in the Netherlands during my second PhD project, which is also funded by the European Horizon 2020 project. So we want to select some strain, Tissocrisis lutea, a brown seawater microalgae that could produce a lot of high-value pigment, fish chancin, very nice pigments for anti-obesity, and also omega-3 fatty acids, DHA. But this strain is isolated from a warm area. So it could only be produced during spring or summer in Europe, even in south part of Portugal, and the production period only half a year. So we want to select some strain that can be produced during winter time. For instance, 15 degrees, 10 degrees. So in the lab, we use photobioreactors running continuous mode with low temperature. So 15 degrees after continuous mode, flush out the old cells and the cells can grow, then flush out the old cells again. After many generations, actually for us, it took us half a year continuous growing. We succeed to pick up one strain that could grow during winter time in Portugal. And of course we need some high throughput tools, for instance, the fluorescence activity cell sorting to pick up the single cell, because it is very important to find the mutant from a large population, because microalgae are very small. They are microorganisms, could be millions cells in your system. So to find the single cell, you need a marker and you need a high selection tool. Then you can pick up, lucky enough, you can find improved strains then they can be produced, let's say, during winter or during very hot temperature, because now the climate change, there are some heat shocks somewhere. The algae will have crash for industry. If you have a stream that is resistant for high temperature, for low temperature, then you can get a very robust stream for the industry.
Wow, this is very interesting. Let me see if I got right what you mentioned. So it is not allowed to do genetic modification of the algae, let's say by CRISPR or other artificial means. But if we allow the natural branching of the genome by reproduction, because the process of replication is not perfect, we can select the ones that have in a bigger degree the features that we like we have been doing with dogs, apples, and almost every animal and plant that we have been in interaction with for the last 100,000 years, and that would be allowed.
Yes, for CRISPR, for genetic engineering, the general tools so far are not allowed in Europe, at least. Let's see. But for some specific countries, actually, they are quite open for GMOs. It is allowed. And also for Europe, actually, the policy is now is getting more and more open, actually. Maybe in the future, because CRISPR is a very nice tool to target editing the products. Currently not allowed for food and feed, but for other purposes, for instance, medicine, for different purposes. But for food or feed, if you select from with a natural environment, natural parameters, to control the temperature, to control the light, to control different parameters during the production, and those strains are allowed because they are assumed as you isolate from the natural environment, because there's natural selection, as you said, that the species will improve. Anyway, there will be some mutants by chance, and then you can select the best ones.
Was spirulina the outcome of this artificial selection by humans of these strands, or was it naturally emergent in nature?
This is a very interesting question. From my side, to be honest, the spirulina was isolated from a local lake in Mexico in a very long time ago. We don't know what is the original method, why they select this, why this strain grown there. Because suddenly the local people, they find they have some blue things growing in the lake and they can use for food. So maybe there's spirulina that, there's one spirulina, the mutant, grows much faster. Then they grow in a large amount, and then local people can harvest as a food. And also in Africa, very long time ago, the local people harvest spirulina from the lake. And so the spirulina can grow in natural lakes. And you have the local people can harvest to mix with their food for daily life.
Wow, this is fascinating.
Of course, there are also people working on spirulina strain selection. For instance, some countries, they don't have a very nice weather for production. Spirulina prefers 37 degrees because it is a sun bacteria, but some countries, they don't have it. So some companies, they use low temperature. So similar approach. And also even in Norway, you know that in Norway, in Iceland, some researchers, they are isolating snow algae from the snow. So some algae can even grow in the snow. Then you can isolate the algae from snow, and you can grow them in a very low temperature. So, yeah.
The little I know about spirulina is that it is an extremely remarkable source of food. It is kind of a master nutrient or food, source of food, isn't it?
Yes. Spirulina is a very nice food because it could have more than 70% of protein, and it doesn't have a normal cell wall, so that the digestibility, the bioaccessibility of the nutrients are high, so people can easily digest it. And spirulina also contain a large amount of minerals. Actually, I worked on spirulina more than 6 years ago for iron deficiency anemia treatment. And the effect of spirulina on iron deficiency anemia treatment is even better than the positive control, the ferrous sulfate. Of course, we don't know specific reasons yet. That's actually what I'm working at ETH to answer. Why? Because maybe because the bioaccessibility, maybe because the structure of the iron is different, or maybe because spirulina also has a lot of phycocyanin, a blue pigment, a natural pigment. Maybe there are some combined structures. So quite interesting. So, and protein as for future food, 70%, also good, very good number. And actually spirulina is a major commercial microalgae biomass in the world, with a total production amount around, I think, more than 12,000 tons of the dry weight. And most of the spirulina produced in China, 70%.
Wow. I've had many women around me in my life who have had problems of iron deficiency, especially during the time of the period in which the body exerts a lot of iron through menstruation. This is a very tough moment, and you feel very weak and not able to exercise. So this is dramatic for the women I've seen around me who have suffered from this. This kind of treatment is revolutionizing.
Yes, actually, mineral deficiencies is the biggest nutritional problems in the world. For instance, iron deficiency affecting more than 2 billion people. 2 billion people, this is a true number. And half of them are anemic. So especially the women and the young people, children. For instance, the children in Africa, more than 60% have this problem. So especially for the low and middle income countries, because they don't have proper food sometimes, the intake of the iron is quite low. So of course you have a lot of problems if you have mineral deficiencies. People, to be honest, from my side, people pay more attention to some diseases like cancer, diabetes, obesity, because it's a huge problem. When you have problem, you suffer a lot. But for micronutrient deficiencies, sometimes you have some low levels, you don't feel too much, but you have a lot of side effects. Then people don't care too much, and they always like fluctuating, like have some situation. But then if you have a long, like relative long-term mineral deficiencies, there could be a lot of diseases associated to iron deficiency. And there are a lot of research about it. For instance, obesity, diabetes, there's some correlations. So to reduce the risk of not only micronutrient deficiency, this problem, but also to reduce other health problems. So it's good to have proper iron sources to avoid the micronutrient deficiencies.
Do you know the possible metabolic reasons of why it is specifically women and children, the ones who suffer the most of iron deficiency and not men?
To be honest, for women, it's clear that the young women, they lost the blood each month. So this is a hemoglobin connected to iron. So this is a very important reason. And for children, the absorption and the food. So this is also a bit different. So that's why it says, and for children, we always like think about to give the best nutrient because they are developing.
Yeah, given that you're working in a lab which touches on epigenetics, let me posit here a fascinating hypothesis which you might be interested in further researching in the future. I think that this is just a complete speculation on my part. Given that women have had all of the evolutionary pressure to develop resistance towards the loss of blood due to the one time per month period that they have been dealing with since humans are humans, I speculate that at a epigenetic level, women have to be adapted to this loss in some way. I have no proof, no evidence, no nothing, but if we can find the epigenetic changes that makes women, because my hypothesis could be proved if we make men lose the same amount of blood per month, and see how they deal with it, proportional obviously to their weight. it's a 15% correction we could do. And if we see that men perish in these conditions of the same amount of blood being lost, we could start to speculate about a epigenetic adaptation that has occurred only in women, which would be very remarkable, and we could start discovering how this works.
Yeah, I think you are really going to a deep level now. To be honest, I cannot answer a question about epigenetics because my background is not about epigenetics. But this could be a very interesting topic for Professor Ferdinand von Meyer, who is the lead of the head of the nutrition and metabolic epigenetics. He knows a lot. And actually, we have team members. They are working on different topics about epigenetics. But my topic, nutrition, is a bit far from that direction. This is, unfortunately, I cannot answer in a proper way, I believe. But what you proposed from my own side, let's see, not in a very scientific level, I think it's a very interesting, it's a very interesting proposal.
Yeah, maybe if we created those changes in men, they would become feminized, and this can completely destroy their metabolism, so maybe it wouldn't be good. But anyways, in general, I see your project as incredibly optimistic. I think this is one of the brightest fields of research, in my opinion, because I see human ingenuity as the last bottleneck in every sense. If you increase the human ingenuity and you allow people to discover new ways of increasing the efficiency of the process we have been having until now, you can make everyone rich. And if you look at the graphs of the percentage of the population who are poor, the historical, you see a dramatic fall in the last 200 years. And this is so remarkable, and no one is talking about it, that there are like 200,000 people coming out of extreme poverty every day for like 50 years. And specifically in where you come from, in China, China has had a dramatic, dramatic improvement in living conditions. This is very, very good. And India is following a bit behind China. I think that your research has the potential of increasing the efficiency of food production by a few orders of magnitude, because you go to the fundamental, you go to the more basic bare bones elements. You see sunlight, air, plant, and you allow the interaction to occur, and then you harness the output. This is so optimistic. Would you agree with me?
Thanks a lot for the kind words. Yes. This is why we are also very excited on this this project. So before in our group and for microalgae, people work more on protein, pigments, lipids. And from 2022 December, I joined the team and we started also look for micronutrients and new micronutrient deficiencies, which is a very important topic. So as you said, that more and more people they are becoming they have a much better conditions than before for food, but the thing is unfortunately for to be honest, for the iron deficiency problem is still there. It's still a huge number. For over the decades, the problem is still there. Of course, this is extremely serious problem for the low and middle income countries, but also for high income countries like developed countries, even in Switzerland, the problem is still there. So we also have some reports about the iron deficiency population in Switzerland, and in Switzerland is a very high income country, but still people have the problem, especially the women. That's why we want to understand and we want to find some innovative way. People always talk about novel food, and different strategies. But there are some, I think there are some gaps. For instance, as I said, algae production experts, they know a lot about microalgae. They don't know too much about nutrition. A nutrition expert, they know a lot about nutrition, different things, but they don't know too much about microalgae. You cannot connect them. And also the absorption, let's say absorption pathways, until today, the heme iron absorption pathways are unknown. So that's why I'm very excited to work with different groups, different people, to connect different gaps, to understand why this is a problem, and what is absorption, how we solve this problem, to compare to conventional ways. Is this good way, better way, or worse way? I'm not saying this is a perfect way, because we also need to approve. But we want to understand what is happening. So this is very important.
I think that the bottleneck in a lot of the oceans of the biomass is iron. And I've seen some videos of people throwing tons of iron into the ocean in form of dust. And after a few days, the amount of biomass has multiplied, maybe not days, but weeks and months. Can you explain a bit on how iron is the bottleneck for living beings in the ocean?
Because in general, the iron concentration in the ocean is very low. In general, natural environment, it is very low. So iron is a limitation for growth of many organisms. Because of very low concentration, some microorganisms, bacteria or different microorganisms, they could produce a secondary metabolite called siderophore. So siderophore is a secondary metabolite the cell can produce around the cell, and this siderophore works as arm, like arm. Then they can grab the iron to deliver to the microorganism. So more or less, this is a balance that they don't have a lot of iron, so they grow with like a limited growth rate. Then the diverse of the organisms are in a natural way. But for instance, if you put some iron, throw some iron in the ocean, the iron is a growth factor. Some microorganisms can use iron in a very quick way. So then they double, triple, and a lot. This could be this string could be the advantage string. The other, there will be problems for the diverse of the microorganisms. So that's also something that is from a natural environment. When we break the balance, something will happen.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, when we break the balance of the parameters, the environment, then something will happen. Species changing, different things. Yeah.
We don't know the long-term consequences of completely obliterating one of the main bottlenecks in nature.
To be honest, from my own side, I cannot claim that. Because also the temperature also changing, different things happening. So we don't know I don't know like a bottleneck, like what is a specific like factor for that.
And even if we added the iron and it was indeed effective for the reproduction of species in the oceans, we don't know which kind of strands will be reproducing the most. So maybe the balance of the biodiversity would be completely altered. We have to be very conservative on these things.
Yeah, actually, I don't know, but this part is there are some scientists and in the world, they have a proposal. Famous scientists, they called iron pollution in the ocean to solve climate change. This is a crazy idea, because if you put a lot of iron, easily the algae will grow a lot. It's a bloom. Then they assume the algae can use iron to have a large population to produce a large amount of CO2. To absorb a large amount of CO2 and produce a lot of oxygen to balance the climate change for the whole Earth. But if we think about it, we don't know if this is a problem for the fish or other species. Of course, very important and very crazy idea, because many, many years ago, a billion years ago, that there was no oxygen in the Earth. The cyanobacteria, microalgae, they produce oxygen. So photosynthesis, oxygen, some crazy ideas could be linked, but I don't know. I'm not sure if this or what will happen now for that. And actually, until Many people, they don't know, for instance, what is the oxygen producer for the whole Earth. Maybe people see the big trees, crops, but actually 70% of the oxygen produced by algae. For instance, 50% produced from diatoms from the ocean. So very important for the environment, for the CO2, for the carbon balance.
This is a fact that completely blew my mind the first time I came across it. I saw a statistic that the Amazon and the big rainforests in our planet are not the lungs of the Earth. Because at a certain point, after millions of years of bioproduction, there's no more room for accumulating carbon. So if there's no carbon capture, there's no net elimination of carbon from the atmosphere. But the place in which there's plenty of room to accumulate carbon in the form of biomass is the ocean. An algae lives, reproduces, and when he dies, it falls to the floor and it accumulates in the form of sediment. And that allows for potentially all of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So we have plenty of room there. And you're 100% right. The lungs of the Earth are not our rainforest. They are our oceans.
Yes.
I'm very curious, what are the different areas in which useful strands of algae have been used to our objectives? Let's say one of them, as you mentioned, was reducing the need for high temperatures, which made them more robust to cold environments. What are other examples you know of?
Yeah, for instance, we have at ETH, we do have a very interesting algae topic, Godiria. So this is algae isolated from a volcano area. So the volcano area, you know that the temperature is very hot, more than 50 degrees. And the pH, it is very low, 1.5. So this algae was isolated from that area, and it can grow at very low pH, very high temperature. Now this is an extreme example. This is very, very interesting. Why? Because with these parameters, we could produce the biomass without contamination. Because other bacteria, they cannot survive with very high temperature, with very low pH. But for other species like Spirulina, Chlorella, those species, the pH is more than 7, Chlorella 7, Spirulina 9.5. For Godiria, 1.5. It is very, it is a unique, let's say, unique condition for that algae. So we could produce that algae with a much higher productivities, with low contamination. So this is also one of the example of that direction. From, yeah, again, we isolated from the some scientists, some people isolated from nature. We're isolating very nice streams from the nature.
Wow, this is incredible. But is there a slight possibility of either horizontal gene transfer of some other living beings taking the part of the genome which has the sequence which allows for living under those dire acid and heat, very hot conditions, or some way in which new adaptations that would build resistance towards these conditions could emerge? Or is it that the barrier of entry, the wall you build between your cultivation of algae and the ones in the environment is so massive that natural selection cannot operate?
Yeah, that could be. Because if you have a very large system, easy to have a natural selection. In general, the natural selection is from a very specific, let's say, specific area, small system, or like the volcano is very specific. In the lab, you put a very small, like a reactor, not very big, then you have a higher chance to get a mutant. So if the system is too big, of course, probably maybe you have more diverse, you have more possibilities because you have more cells. But then you also have a challenge to find it, to find the mutant. So that's very complex. I would say that's very complex situation.
I always fear that at some point we will discover a mutant that has so much fitness in comparison to what nature has been able to produce that it will overtake the world. Let's say in a virus or in a plant which spreads too much. Do you think this is science fiction or is it a possibility?
I don't know if this is scientific. Someone talked with me before because, for instance, the climate change and the temperature is much higher than before. Some bacteria from the frozen area, they never wake up before. But now if they wake up, they will take over the world, for instance, some fungi or something. And there's no limitations for them. Then all the resources, they take it. So to be honest, I'm not an expert. I don't know. The theory is there. I would not say it is impossible, but I also don't know if this is possible. It's all this is like over talking a bit. But for microalgae, for instance, for this species like pH 1.5, there's no risk. Why? Because our environment is neutral. They cannot survive. They can only grow at specific conditions. For instance, in reactor, you should provide the condition, then they can alive. If you release them to the nature, they die because the pH is not good for them. But for other like climate change, some species, fungi, different things with a high temperature, we don't know. So yeah, that's very interesting, actually very interesting topic. I think more and more people are talking about it because with climate change, with environmental change, there are a lot of new things are happening.
Luckily, in nature, there are many more variables than the only one we select for.
Yes.
This would be analogous.
Yes, I think we should believe the balance ability of the nature, of the Earth. It will give a balance. If you have a bad bacteria, maybe another bacteria will balance it.
This is analogous to in MMA, people who specialize in judo or in karate, they are very good in doing the thing they are specialized in, but then they meet someone from jiu-jitsu or someone who has a more broad amount of optimizations, even if he's not the best in any of the specific areas, and they beat them because there's so many other variables for which you have to optimize. Yes. And you cannot do it for all of them in a lab.
Yeah, true. That's how I agree, yeah.
It's been a very enjoyable conversation, Gao. It's very enlightening and optimistic, and it aligns a lot with my opinion about how the universe works. I think that humans are positive sum. I think that the existence of other humans adds value to others, thanks especially for the heavy hitters of scientific contributions like you, who are adding much more value to society than what you take as a form of a salary, I bet. And yeah, I wish you a lot of success in your future endeavors.
Thanks a lot, Alex. Thanks a lot. Very nice conversation with you.